Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of December. The Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee is celebrating its 40th anniversary, and Deborah Mason is giving their keynote speech today in celebration of that 40th anniversary. We will be talking, among many other topics, about interfaith dialogue during the course of this hour. She is the executive director of the Religion News Writers Association. She teaches at the University of Missouri School of Journalism and is the director of the Center on Religion and Professions there. She has written extensively about religion news and how it has been covered, which I think is fascinating, from the colonial era to the present. She serves on the editorial board and is a book review editor for the Journal of Media and Religion. She holds a doctoral degree in mass communications from Ohio University in Athens, a master's in journalism from Northwestern University, and a master's in theological studies from Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus. We have much to talk about. They are currently compiling a list of the top religious stories. And when you listen to the news from the perspective of the moral element involved in the news, many stories could be considered to have a religious or a moral aspect. They also are currently deciding who the top religious leader newsmaker of the year was, so you may want to keep that in mind as you call in during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our number two of our program today, former Vice President Walter Mondale will be with us. He's written a really lovely and interesting book about his years as a senator, what got him into politics, and we could say the answer was Hubert Humphrey, and his years, many years as a senator in a fairly liberal Congress. The book is The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. So Walter Mondale is coming up, hour number two. Deborah, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you.
We'll get to the 10 stories in a moment, but let's start with the story that is very much on people's minds today and has been for the past couple weeks, and you will be able to give me an answer as to how you frame this issue if you're a religion reporter or if you're a reporter covering religion. And it's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which some people will say has a very strong religious component to it. Others will say this is a civil rights issue and perhaps the most important civil rights issue of our time. If you are covering this issue, it seems to me as though you've got a difficult assignment to cover both aspects of this. How do you do it?
Well, I would say that for the most part, the way it is done is that the religious element has been removed from it. Many stories like this, one of the difficulties in the media is that religion gets stripped out of it, and it's covered by a Washington Press Corps predominantly that focuses on the political aspect and on the political gamemanship, so to speak, of the issue. And so religion doesn't get mentioned. Usually when it is included, it's included as, this group is for it, this group is against it, and perhaps in a broader context, not in this particular case, but in broader LGBT rights issues as a funding issue. What we need is an integrated coverage. We need to be able to include religion as a component of these complex stories. Otherwise, we're shortchanging and trivializing some of those arguments.
Hmm. I had an interesting interview with Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, some months ago. It was probably a year ago. Time goes so fast. But she talked about all of a sudden realizing in negotiations with leaders all over the world, maybe you read her book, which was really good, that religion was important. And diplomats had been trained to keep religion out of the topic. It was too divisive. Don't go there. And she realized she was missing a huge part of diplomacy, that she had to understand religious views and the importance of religion in a country.
Right. And we do the same thing with journalism.
Uh-huh.
Journalists, for the most part, very few journalists have any sort of training or professional background in religion. They may have grown up in a faith tradition. They may practice a faith tradition. But what we know is that doesn't make you an expert in that tradition. And it doesn't help you understand the etiquette and the nuance that is present in all faith traditions. And so we have the same problems. I work at a major school of journalism, and although students there have to take liberal arts courses, they could easily bypass any religion in their education there whatsoever. And so that's a problem. And I think we have a larger problem of religious illiteracy. I can talk more about that later. But the problem of religious illiteracy is a huge problem just among our general population as a whole.
Right.
It's a crisis, I would say.
And you certainly realize that when you have a major story after 9/11 and trying to get a crash course in the Muslim faith in this world. Mm-hmm. And we still are having a crash course in that. Who are extremists? How many are there? Where are
That's
they
right.
educated? It's not a part of the whole faith. It's a very big story that we just didn't know very much about.
And we still don't. You know, what's fascinating to me is that the polls show that there has been very little change in what people say they understand about Muslims. And that is, I think, quite damning for the media, because I think we've worked hard at trying to do something about that, trying to educate the public. But I wonder, you know, and I don't have the answer, what are some of the other issues there that has led to this difficulty in moving any sort of public awareness or public knowledge, self-described public knowledge? We're not trying to lead the questions. We're asking people, what do you know about Muslims or about the Islamic faith? And the numbers haven't changed significantly since 9/11.
Well, that's not good.
No, it's a crisis, I think.
I'm really interested that you know all about, because I know nothing about this, how religion has been covered way back in American history, including colonial times. Was there much more thorough, better coverage of religion at that time?
Well, you know, it was more integrated at that time.
Was it?
I mean, you know, when the Puritans came to this country, and of course, newspapers were just starting at the same time. And so there was a lot of irregularity in terms of how the media covered anything at that time. But, you know, it was integrated as part of life. It was the reason that decisions were made politically often, and we had faith leaders who were, you know, kind of the equivalent of pop stars at the time. And they were, you know, celebrities of sort. And what they said was reported. Now, that said, it was a very different style in colonial era. And really, we don't see journalism as a whole in any topic being kind of professionalized or starting to get more modern sorts of norms until the Civil War era. And that's when journalism started developing certain practices and routinizing certain processes. And that's when we start seeing religion being covered for the first time as an institution. And there were James Gordon Bennett, who owned the New York Herald, was involved in trying to cover religion the way you would cover City Hall. And that's what he tried to practice, and that process caught on through the 1800s. And then, you know, by about the turn of the century, about the 1900s, almost every newspaper across the country had a dedicated religion section. Now, it didn't necessarily include quality news. It was mostly listings and announcements and sermon topics and so on. So we saw changes in the next century that would help professionalize the practice of covering religion, just like we saw in the coverage of health and medicine and education. There was a huge professionalization in the 1900s of journalism as a whole.
So in the Civil War time, what were the stories, the religious stories that were being covered?
Well, of course, slavery. You know, slavery was tearing apart faith communities. And of course, we had religious institutions that evolved or split up based on how that faith group approached the issue of slavery. So that was one thing that was obvious and was enormous. Immigration was certainly the growing number of Catholics, early waves of Jewish immigrants. These were quite divisive in the 1800s because it had been a predominantly Protestant culture in our country. And this affected the schools, for instance. So the schools, you used the Bible to learn to read. The Bible was often used to teach children how to read. Well, when the number of Catholics grew, there was disagreement over what is the Bible, because Catholics use a different, slightly different version of the Bible than most Protestants. And that's when we saw the creation of public schools, and we saw religion starting to be stripped out of the educational process. And that, frankly, began our journey toward religious illiteracy in the 1800s. But you also had other fascinating stories. I mean, you had the Christian Scientists were being founded. Then you had the Mormon Church was being founded, and all those struggles involving polygamy and the trek of the Mormons across the country that really had some significant roles in U.S. jurisprudence. And so those were all some of the stories that you see on the front pages of the papers back then.
Do you think it would add to our tolerance, and it's important enough that we should teach in as secular a way as possible all the major faiths in public schools?
I think there's a huge value to that. I have a 17-year-old and a 16-year-old, and
you got fun in the house.
Yeah. That's one way to describe it. But one of our high schools in town has a really well-known course in world religions, and my kids are at the other high school, and so they haven't had that opportunity. And I think that's really tragic in some ways. They do address religion and its role in civilization, the development of civilization, and so on, but it's quite a sterile way of describing it. But, the Bible can be taught as literature. That's one confusion over...
I took a course in that.
Right. And so, that's the Bible has so much... there are so many metaphors and so much language that we pick up and use in political language, in our rhetoric, our culture wars rhetoric. And, children who don't learn that are at a loss. At the same time, we've had growing religious diversity, and I think this is really where the need has been. There were immigration changes in the mid-1960s, and this brought many more immigrants from Southeast Asia, from really all the Asian countries, from predominantly Muslim countries. And so the first wave, significant waves of Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists started coming over in the late 50s and in the 1960s. So nowadays, it's not unusual. I live in a community of about 100,000 people. We have a Hindu temple. We have a mosque. We have several Buddhist centers. And that's typical. I mean, this is in the middle of the Midwest. And this is going to keep growing. It's going to increase. And increasingly, our neighbors are going to be more and more diverse. And at the same time, we know less and less about the faiths that they practice and the values that drive their everyday decisions about life.
What we do is explode a story, and I'd like for your general assessment of the story that stayed with us for some time, the pastor, I put him in quotes, in Florida, who was going to burn the Korans, and he was on the news and cable news all the time in protest of building a mosque in New York City. How did the press cover that, responsibly or not?
Well, they did a horrible job of covering that. Now, interestingly, I think you have to look at it with a little more of a fine-tooth comb. Initially, it was, I will say, kind of exploited by large national media entities and that don't necessarily have specialists, people who cover religion regularly. And I think... I started asking my colleagues who cover religion, asking them about that story. And I said, did you cover that? I asked Lori Goodstein at the New York Times, did you cover that or how did you approach that? Well, most religion reporters recognized Terry Jones. This is the gentleman in Florida who threatened to burn the Quran. We've seen these Terry Joneses all the time. He has a very small congregation. He's fairly bombastic in his approach. And really what he says doesn't really matter a whole lot. And so, it was a huge mistake to give him any kind of a national forum. And I think we saw gradually the media started realizing that, hey, this guy is inexperienced in a national playing field of commentary and so on. He's inconsistent. He really doesn't mean anything. And the religion reporters knew that right away. And it took a while before the real loudest voices in the media figured that out. And that was a tragedy because that was a non-story right from the get-go, I think.
You said something very important, I think. Well, a lot of what you said is important. But this idea that we make big things over things that don't matter. Life is too short to deal with things that, and the issues are so profound, to deal with something that doesn't matter.
Right.
What a waste of our time.
Right. And you know, again, like I say, anybody who has covered religion regularly will recognize that kind of person, that Terry Jones sort of persona. And every town has one or two of them. They're not unique, and they're fringe. And as such, you know, they're not any part of mainstream thought or practice among the faith community.
We have many phone calls. We'll go to them momentarily. Deborah Mason is our guest. She is giving the keynote speech at the 40th anniversary of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. Her speech is today. She's the executive director of the Religion News Writers Association, teaches at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, is the director of the Center on Religion and the Professions there, and she has written extensively about religion in this country and how the press has covered it from colonial times, don't you find that fascinating, till now. Our number, one line open, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, former Vice President Walter Mondale, longtime U.S. Senator, author of The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. So that's coming up, hour number two. We welcome phone calls for Deborah, starting with Tim from Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Excellent program. Very enlightening. Thank you, Deborah, for your comment.
You're welcome.
I think I'm a pastor and a Christian.
Could you speak up just a little bit, Tim?
Oh, I'm sorry.
There you go.
One of my frustrations with the media in today's society is, and I think this started taking place probably post-1950s, especially escalated, the secularization of America, this amazing amount of disinformation about our faith, and I think there's a driving force behind it, unfortunately. But I think one of the frustrating things with what Christians see oftentimes with the way the press covers, especially Christianity, is this kind of thumbing your nose at Christians or looking down your nose at Christians or and talking of issues they really don't know anything about in these broad, sweeping, stereotypical terms. A prime example, recently I saw something on Yahoo about the Tea Party movement, that most Tea Partiers were conservative, Bible-believing Christians, and the implication was because of that, somehow they're not quite as intelligent as people that aren't religious. And that's kind of a constant polarization among Christians against journalists, that, you know, find your facts and learn something before you talk about things. So, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Deborah.
Sure. Well, I think just like you have to be careful about generalizing in terms of what all Tea Partiers believe or what all Christians believe, for instance, you do have to be careful about lumping all journalists into one big pot. And that's particularly one of my pet peeves. We use the word media to cover a lot of things out there that I really wouldn't consider professional journalism. So one of the things that I hope that listeners and readers will do when they're looking at the media is trying to discern what is quality professional journalism and what is not. That's my little soapbox advertisement for the moment. But in terms of your specifics, you know, the surveys really show that among journalists there is somewhat of a more secular orientation. But that there are many, many people of faith within the media as well. And so, again, there is a stereotype, and it's kind of set up as this dichotomy, you know, secular versus religious. And I don't find it there. It's not that simple, frankly. I think that the problem with why you see those kinds of broad generalizations in the media really has much more to do with the practice of journalism today, with the time span that journalists have. You know, it's 24 24/7. It's get it up and get it up as quickly as possible. And with a complicated topic like religion, it's a huge disservice. The way we practice journalism today, with the economic stresses that are affecting newspapers, television stations, radio stations, and the like, have made it so that any in-depth topic, whether it's religion or the environment or science, all of these topics have been greatly reduced and hurt by the current economic cycle and the transformation that's going on in journalism. So it is more complicated than that. And I would also say that in the really we saw a huge flowering and growth of religion news in the 1980s and the 1990s until this the economics started hurting coverage of religion. And so I would say that it really didn't start quite in the 1950s. I think it's more of an up and down kind of a thing than a straight line. But you're right, there are lots of issues there that need to be addressed, but I don't think it's nearly as simple as it's often portrayed.
Thank you very much, Tim, for the call. That brings up all kinds of questions. Of course, one question here leads to tons of them, because he talked about maybe poo-pooing Christianity mm-hmm. and the Tea Party. I noticed that one of your newsmakers, and it could be, we've got four here, she could be the newsmaker of the year, is Sarah Palin, whose second bestseller devotes nearly one-fourth of the book to her insistence that candidates for office take a public Christian stand. We are in a country where we really don't want our politicians, many of us, to say too much about religion, or certainly don't want them to take a public Christian stand. What about the element of religion in the Tea Party movement, and what about our desire to have our politicians be people of faith, but don't wear it on your sleeve?
Well, I think we've gone almost beyond we don't want our politicians to wear their faith on their sleeve. I think we've almost gotten to the point where religion has become a litmus test. And there have been surveys that suggest that, atheists and Muslims are the least likely to ever be elected to public office. So I do actually think that the expectations for somebody being a person of faith have risen in the last couple decades. That said, in terms of religion and the Tea Party, I don't think anybody's really done a good analysis of this. I'm not sure we even quite know. I think, like Tim indicated, there's been this generalization that Tea Partiers are all, Sarah Palin wannabes or followers, and I don't. It's definitely not that simple. There's definitely a diverse group of people there, and I don't think I haven't seen any really strong surveys of it. Maybe they're out there, I just haven't seen it, in terms of the religiosity component of those groups. What we do know, though, is that most Tea Partiers may have been disaffected Republicans. And we do know that that evangelicals, for instance, vote the most consistently Republican, and several other faith groups, like Mormons, vote most consistently Republican compared to other groups like Catholics or white Protestants or black Protestants and so on. Mm-hmm. So
let's talk about Kennedy for a moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm thinking about him when I talk about not wearing it on her sleeves. How did the press cover his Catholicism? I know I didn't realize he had talked about it at his acceptance speech, which he did. He just took mm-hmm. it right off the bat. And then as the campaign went on, he spoke about it. And it became a non-issue after a while. How did the press cover his Catholicism? Did they ignore it or did they explore it?
Oh, no. There was quite a lot of coverage of it. In fact, significant coverage. And, I think the reason you said, the reason it kind of went away was that Kennedy addressed it in a very high-profile meeting with clergy, where he talked about his view and really described a very strong separation of church and state view. There were concerns. And there was, in the 1950s, there was still a lot of, I would say, undercurrents of conflict between Protestants and Catholics. I mean, you still had prohibitions between Protestants marrying Catholics, and so all of these sorts of things came out in terms of the coverage. And one of the things that's interesting is beginning in the 1960s is when we started to see coverage of Roman Catholics become more prominent, and eventually by the 1970s, the Catholics were reported on more often than Protestants, and that was definitely a change that started to take place with the Kennedy presidency and moving forward.
We go next to Jim from Lake Geneva. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen, and hi, Debbie. This is a great program. I'm in my mid-70s, and I was educated in an immigrant church on the south side of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And our education came from people who were in the trenches. It was, like I say, an Italian immigrant church, and our priest and were immigrants. And we lived in the culture of immigration, and we lived in a culture of tolerance of in the city that, I got to say, there were many, many ghettos of Polish, German, Irish, and I think the moral teachings were done with the on the feet. These clergy spoke out for labor, they spoke out for unions, they spoke out for rights and human rights. And I think that I'm still a member. I am a church, you know. I'm a member of a church, but I belong to Voces de la Fonteta, and we are among many people of many faiths. But our campaign and our struggle is always for the human rights. And what is happening today is a real violation of our immigrants' rights. I can't imagine being Irish. I know we were persecuted, but by the time I came along, we had gone through that and we had won the battles. But I always look to the church to, and sometimes and many times disappointed because of their lack of, and maybe I'm being too critical, but their lack of a voice on these this immigrant issue today. It was a great victory last night for children of undocumented immigrants that come here, and all they have done nothing. They just came with their parents.
Yeah, well, I think you were fortunate in that you came past some of that. But if you look at, say, newspapers in the in the 1880s, for instance, Catholics were all referred to as Papists. They weren't referred to as Catholics. The headlines all said Papists. And if you remember you wouldn't remember, but in the 1920s, there was the KKK, particularly in the Midwest and Indiana and places like that, was staunchly anti-Catholic, and there was a lot of anti-Catholic rhetoric and anti-Semitic rhetoric. But you are right in that these days, when you look at surveys and how people view various faiths, Catholics and Jews and Protestants are viewed quite favorably by the public, in around the 80th percentile. But when you look at, for instance, Muslims, you're down to about 35 to 50% of the population viewing Muslims favorably. And so there is definitely a difference today in how we view Catholics and Jews and Protestants versus how we view Muslims particularly. I don't think public opinion when it comes to Hindus and Buddhists is really well evaluated, well surveyed, because those numbers are much harder to get. They're much smaller groups and spread out across the country.
Thank you very much, Jim, for the call. One of the huge stories, of course, for the past few years has been sex abuse in the Catholic Church and the cover-up of that story. I was interested in those numbers that you gave. I'm wondering how people view the hierarchy of the Catholic Church and what your thoughts are on the difficulty of covering this story for a reporter because so much material was not at hand, and the impact of this story on the Church.
Well, I think any person who specializes in covering religion, particularly at a mainstream newspaper, has had calls over the years from people who say they have been abused. I had those calls when I was a religion reporter. You're stuck in many ways because so many of the documents are private, and because you get into a he said, she said sort of thing. There's no litigation involved and those kinds of things. I'm talking about pre-2000. I'm talking about, you know, this is in the 1980s and 1990s. When the Boston Globe started reporting about significant cases of abuse and the involvement of cardinal law and church hierarchy in terms of moving abusive priests around the country, that really broke open these cases all across the country, and journalists just started getting calls after calls. You also had advocacy groups form that helped abuse victims. You had, kind of networks of lawyers who became experts both at acquiring documents, church documents, and also acquiring, other legal sorts of documents that told some of these stories. And without those documents, really, it's quite difficult to report on abuse. This story is probably had the most impact on religion reporters of any that I can recall. And the reason being is that there was quite a frenzy among editors to cover these stories. And so some religion reporters would end up covering only abuse stories day after day, day after day, listening to stories of broken lives and of people who had attempted to commit suicide, people with significant mental problems and family problems. And we had a very high burnout rate among religion reporters. And I also will mention that it can have an enormous effect on a person's personal faith as well. And so journalists who are people of faith, and particularly journalists who are Catholic, I think it was a enormous strain to cover this story. That said, it was vital, and it had to be told. I think what we want to make sure is that we're not only telling those stories, because of course there are many, many other stories, and because the vast majority of priests and clergy are enormously hardworking, important, significant people in their communities, and have no role in abuse whatsoever.
Does this result, though, in the substantial change in the structure of the church, the enormous breadth and scope of this scandal, how people's lives were affected, and how the press treated the issue and pounded on it eventually, will it change the church in substantial ways, women in the priesthood, perhaps, a whole different way of governing the church?
I hate to speculate on that, but I would say the one thing people need to always remember is that most churches change slowly, and the Catholic Church in particular is a very hierarchical church, and I think all the signals that we've received from Pope Benedict XVI is that, no, it's not going to affect who is a priest or the gender of who the priests are. I think what it has done is put into place, procedures at the seminary level, particularly to try to evaluate seminarians and to try to keep people who might be potential abusers out of the priesthood. And so that certainly has been good. I think there's probably a lot more that could be done. And I think that the press needs to be continued to be vigilant about this because it's not going to go away.
Comfort the afflicted.
Yeah, afflict the comfortable. Yeah.
It really is a part of that story.
It is.
Let's go to Parker from Madison. Hi, Parker.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you both for an excellent program. You mentioned schools of journalism not taking religion seriously, not preparing their students to understand it. And my general question is, perhaps, why is it that academic institutions and programs at large have not only a bias against the academic or objective study of religion, but really have practiced a kind of studied ignorance about it, given their commitment to knowledge. Religion has played a huge role in every phase of human history. I was just thinking of, you know, the 4th century alliance between the church and Rome, the rise of monasticism mm-hmm. and the roots of the university, the Protestant ethic and the spirit mm-hmm. of capitalism, Japan's leap from a feudal society to a modern industrial superpower in 50 or 60 years. It didn't start with 9/11. And it seems to me that to say that that academics have a secular orientation doesn't explain enough, because you don't have to believe in something to teach about it. People teach about the Nazi ideology. They don't believe in it, but mm-hmm. they understand that students need to know about these features of the modern world. So why not religion? What's wrong with the academy?
Well, I think I would disagree with you on one thing there. I mean, first of all, I'm a member of the American Academy of Religion, and these are scholars of religious studies. I mean, that's all they do is teach about religion. And that organization is over 10,000 members, I believe. And these members are predominantly in the United States at academic institutions. And so there are lots of people out there teaching about religion in religious studies. And there are, you know, even at the University of Missouri, I mean, we have courses about religion in the geology department, in the history department, political science, and so on. So the courses are there when it comes to general education sorts of courses. So I would disagree on that front. Now, journalism specifically, there are two things going on. One is that we are in the midst of enormous curriculum changes and enormous transformation in the media. I mean, that's no secret, of course. And so what we need to teach our students has grown significantly, just in terms of simple skills and things like that. And so there's great pressure in the curriculum in terms of how many courses can you squeeze in and what are the topics in those courses. So that's one thing that tends to squeeze out the specialized journalism courses. They do exist at the largest journalism schools across the country. They exist. I mean, you can take a course in religion and media at University of Missouri, at Columbia University, at University of Southern California, University of South Carolina. I mean, I could go on and on and on with places where you can take a very specific course in covering religion. The problem is that these are electives, and most students at the college level, I find, and I'm an advocate for these kinds of courses, and I teach one of these myself, but I find that most students in journalism at that point haven't recognized the importance of religion in world events and in political events and in our culture, and they haven't figured out how important it is to take that sort of a course. So it's, again, like most things, it's a little more complicated and nuanced. But the religion courses themselves, I mean, they're there in plentiful selections all across the country. And, of course, let's not even forget all the private institutions that have religion foundations. I mean, my bachelor's is from a small liberal arts Lutheran college, and, we were required to take religion courses at those sorts of institutions. So many people do get those kinds of courses or are offered the opportunity.
If I could ask just sure. one more question with thanks for your response.
Yeah.
It seems to me that generally courses in religion are electives, and
right.
students don't understand the importance of taking them. But isn't it the function of the university to require people to learn things that they don't yet know are important? And mm-hmm. why is it that the university does not include, it marginalizes religion in that sense? I know lots of members of the association that you belong to, uh-huh. many of whom feel marginalized in their own academic settings.
I think you are right there. I think it's, what you're starting to see is that some schools are looking at the notion of diversity requirements on a broad base. Many, you know, we have a diversity requirement in the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri, and it does include religion as a small component of that course, and nursing has such a requirement in education and so on. And so there are these cross-cultural courses or diversity, multicultural courses. They have lots of different names. And religion is also often a component, but it's not a significant component. And I think what we're starting to see is the recognition that, particularly when it comes to, say, Islam, or when you're talking about faiths that have very different sorts of etiquette and practice, that we need to start broadening our notion of diversity and multicultural education courses where they're required, and starting to make sure that religion is included and respected as part of that. And I think you are starting to see that very slowly, but you're right. I think, you know, there are not very many places where the religious studies department is held up as the, you know, the epitome of excellence at a university.
Hmm. Are you a professor of religious studies, Parker?
Well, I'm yes and no. I've written about these matters for 40 years and have a PhD in the sociology of religion. Robert Bellow was at Berkeley, was
sure.
my major professor. So these have been matters of great interest to me, and I've actually written a number of books about the role of spirituality and religion in higher education. So I know there's an audience out there, and I appreciate the nuanced analysis of it that your guest just offered. I do think that there's a lot of work to be done in helping folks who would never say that ignorance of Nazism is okay, but would say that ignorance of fundamental facts about the great world's religions is just fine. That's sort of an optional matter.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm going to put you on hold. Chrissy will get your name, because we may want to talk to you down the road, too. Thanks, Parker, very much for the call. We need to take more phone calls momentarily. We are talking about religion as a news beat, religion in the news, religion in our lives. Deborah Mason is our guest this hour. She is giving a keynote address at the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, celebrating its 40th anniversary. We haven't even asked her about the interfaith movement in this country and whether or not it's charging ahead or in decline. We'll ask her that. She's giving the keynote speech. She is the executive director of the Religious Newswriters Association. She teaches at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. She is director of the Center on Religion and Professions there, and she has written extensively about religion news in this country from the colonial era to the present. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, former Vice President Walter Mondale, the son of a minister, we might add, and to tie the hours together, and his father had a big influence on his life. He's the author of his memoir, The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. Our number is 800-486-8655. Before we go back to phone calls, Deborah, what about the interfaith movement? How strong is it? Is it growing in this country? What is it?
What is it? Well, that's a good question. You know, the interfaith movement started in the early 1900s and was quite strong and influential, actually, had some really significant roles as public intellectuals. Then we started to see it really decline. The main supporters, largest supporters of interfaith movement have been mainline Protestant congregations. And those congregations, it's probably no surprise to listeners, have been losing numbers at a pretty significant rate. And so as their funding and their numbers have declined, their support of these interfaith groups, not their philosophical support, but their financial backing has declined. And obviously this affects what an interfaith group can do. Recently, however, they're really with 9/11, what we saw is sort of a renewed charge and a renewed vision, I think, among many interfaith groups that we needed to get back to this hard work of figuring out how do we live as people of faith, of diverse faiths, as neighbors and in a larger context in a world where our faith traditions are at war. Particularly in the global South, where there is incredible growth and conflict among faith traditions. And so what we're starting to see is really efforts. They're I would say, small, and I would say that they're spotty here and there, to really broaden up this paradigm of the United States as a Protestant, Catholic, Jewish nation to a Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim country, broadening it to embrace all the Abrahamic faiths in interfaith dialogue. And I don't want to single out the, you know, Hinduism or Baha'i or Buddhists or Sikhs, but those numbers are very small, and they in some places they are participants, in some places they aren't, and it's hard to get a reading on trends when it comes to those faith traditions.
We go next to Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin. The idea of a religion is to unite people under one belief system, which could be one yoke, so they can be manipulated and led in any which direction. So you have all these wars that have been going on all throughout history. You had the Catholics versus the Protestants in Ireland, the Croats and the Serbs, and you had the Hindus versus the Muslims in Pakistan. You have Jews versus Muslims in Palestine. You have I'm just going to cease to
right. We
to
we
talk,
get the
but,
point.
But I got to tell you, even the German soldier in World War II wore a belt buckle that said "God be with us." President Bush said that this war in the Middle East was a crusade. Is religion dangerous?
Well, you know, as a journalist, I don't want to make a statement as to one opinion or another, but I will just say that I think one of the things the media doesn't do well enough is covering the good things that religion does. And, of course, religion has been integral in the creation of civilization and in language and in invention and in art and in culture and in many, many things that are important to us today. And so, I do think that the media has overwhelmingly covered religion from a conflict frame. And I think that's important to do. I don't think it's that we should ignore that. But on the other hand, as in most things with religion, it's a very complicated topic, and there are many, many, many other stories that need to be told.
Thank you, Mike, very much for the call. We go next to Karen from Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kathleen. Wonderful program. Many, many, many years ago, I graduated from a small Lutheran liberal arts college also in Minnesota, St. Olaf, and I had such wonderful religion professors there. We had a requirement also to take religion classes, and one of the theologians that I discovered through those classes was Martin Buber, mm-hmm. who wrote I and Thou. Mm-hmm. And one of his statements has just stayed with me my whole life, and that is, God made so many different kinds of people. Why would he allow only one way to serve him? So then, upon graduation, I went to Asia, and I taught in Borneo for almost 3 years.
You taught where? I'm sorry.
I taught in Borneo.
Oh.
And in our school there, it was a Chinese Christian school. We had Christian Chinese students. We had Buddhist Chinese students. We had a lot of Muslim students. We had many, many different religions. And then on our school registration form, there was also a box that you could check that said pagan. So that was for everything else. And in 1963, that was not considered the wrong kind of statement to make. At any rate, before I went in my training in the summer, I got to hear the Anglican Bishop of Hong Kong, Bishop Hall, who spoke to all of us who were going out to many different places in the world. And this was a Protestant gathering of lots of Protestant denominations. And he told us that when we got to the places that we went, one of the things that we should remember is that God has two hands, a right hand and a left hand, and you may believe that you are working under God's right hand, but wherever you see an act of kindness, an act of love, an act of mercy, God's left hand is at work no matter who does that. Well, I realize now after many years that some people probably think I'm working under God's left hand, and that's just fine with me. And I realize, too, that there are people who don't believe that there is a God. Then I go back to Carl Jung, who said my other favorite quote about religion and God, and that was that hidden or unbidden God is present. I really believe that what is causing so much of the difficulty that we have in being tolerant is that there's a great fear of really pretty rapid change mm-hmm. in our nation particularly.
I need to hold you there because we are just about out of time, Karen. Thank you very much for your thoughtful comments. And we are almost out of time because we're at a time when we do lists and because you're thinking about stories that will stay with us beyond this year. As you think about the huge stories that have profound religious ramifications of 2010, they are?
Well, certainly the earthquake in Haiti. Probably every community across this country has sent missionaries or folks to go to Haiti through their congregations to work there. And the devastation that was brought there and the following buildup and the support, I think, has been fueled in many ways by people of faith and by thankless volunteers who have worked very hard. And I think it's hard to top that.
We need to hold. We'll hold it with that
okay,
thought. Thank
great,
you very much,
great.
Deborah, for being with us. And Deborah is speaking today, the keynote speaker at the Interfaith Conference of Milwaukee 40th anniversary. Deborah Mason, our guest, Executive Director of the Religion News Writers Association. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And we have Walter Mondale with us, hour number two, so please stay with us.